The Guardian.
This podcast is sponsored by audible.co.uk, the number one online destination for digital audiobooks.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Andrew. Nice to see you.
Well, it's right at the beginning of the year, but you're a smart guy. You've made billions of dollars on the internet. What's going to happen in 2013?
The new year is a good time of the year to rethink your priorities, rethink your health, and make some positive changes in your life. She says one of the key things to keep in mind is don't try to do too much. It can lead to burnout or a failing resolution.
History in the making.
Hello and welcome to the first podcast of 2013. Well, that's to say the first one recorded here live in the studio. We hope you enjoyed the feast of short stories we laid on to sustain you over the holidays. This week we'll be talking to the author of one of the first paperbacks of the new year, the mathematician Daniel Tammet.
Thinking in numbers is a mind-expanding, kinetic, aesthetic experience. Tammet's poetic mathematics are beautiful guideposts for thinking about life and even love. As I read, I found myself saying, yes, this is true, and this is true, and this is so true. Amy Tan.
Thinking in numbers enlarges one's wonder at Tammet's mind and his all-embracing vision of the world as grounded in numbers. Oliver Sacks, MD.
And we'll be looking at the year ahead. So, to begin with the new year, which from our bibliophile perspective looks like a literary bid for world domination. We're going to have P.G. Wodehouse on television and F. Scott Fitzgerald in the cinema. A lot of you will already have seen the film adaptation of Jan Martel's Life of Pi, which has been doing great business in cinemas around the world. Also on their way to a film house near you are Mohsin Hamid's The Reluctant Fundamentalist, David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas, a Dostoevsky novella, The Double, and, of course, the second instalments of both The Hunger Games and The Hobbit. But for those of you who prefer books to be books, there are riches in store too. With me to discuss them are Sarah Crown, editor of the Guardian Books website, and Benedicta Page, associate editor of The Bookseller. Happy New Year to both of you.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Claire.
Ben, I've just given a pretty upbeat intro. Do you think I'm right to be so cheerful about the state of publishing?
Yes, by and large, I do. When we look at how the last year has panned out, we're just getting the final end of year figures. And we see that although there's been a little bit of pressure on the print market, it has dropped a little bit, there has been huge growth digitally. So we see that overall, people are reading more books, which is fantastic. Of course, it's difficult for publishers to make money in the same way. So publishers are having a difficult time, but they're responding in a very inventive and creative way to the challenges that the digital transition is throwing at them. So I think, yes, we should be optimistic about the next year.
Sarah, is there going to be a big story this year? I mean, last year was all about Kindles and 50 Shades of Grey, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think the thing about big stories is that it's absolutely impossible to see them coming. And while we could probably have predicted the ongoing advance of the Kindle, certainly 50 Shades of Grey was nothing but a twinkle in a publisher's eye this time last year. And if we'd said 12 months ago that we would be sitting here now talking about the fact that 2012 was the year of the soft-born S&M novel, well, I don't think we would have believed one another, but here we are. So in 12 months' time, God, who knows, we'll probably be back here saying who'd have thought that crochet manuals were going to be the next big thing. As things stand at the minute, probably the biggest waves are being made by an SF novel, which is called Wool, and by a guy called Hugh Howey. And that's something else that's come again from the self-publishing stable, which seems to be where a lot of the big stories are coming from at the minute. He published his book initially as just a 60-page story back in, I think it was July 2011, and he's turned it into a 500-page novel. It was picked up on by Atlantic. He's got publishing deals on both sides of the Atlantic. And apparently Ridley Scott has bought the film rights to it. And apparently it is genuinely good. So at the minute, he's maybe your best bet for the man we'll be talking about in a year's time, as having swept all before him in 2013.
Ben, talk a bit about the trends that you see coming up. I know Sarah's poo-pooing the idea of being able to foresee anything, but actually I am relying on you as somebody who works for the publisher's Bible to know these things.
Well, Sarah is, in fact, exactly right in that you cannot predict those massive phenomena that take over the industry and bring people who never usually read a book into reading. Those do seem to happen, in general, once every few years. So people like Dan Brown or J.K. Rowling or E.L. James. But there are some trends that we can see that have begun this year that are likely to go further. So this rather curious area, new adult publishing, a gap in the market I never knew existed.
As opposed to young adult.
That's right.
What's the difference?
What it means is it is the upper end of young adult and the early 20s.
So i.e. it's the people who grew out of Harry Potter but couldn't leave it behind.
I don't think so. No, because it's much more related to the erotica phenomenon.
Oh.
It's basically romances, but rather racy, steamy romances set in college. There are quite a lot of them in America, but publishers over here are getting very into them and signing up large numbers. They quite often come in trilogies and, you know, there's a college student and a bad boy she can't resist and so on and so forth.
People who grew out of Sweet Valley High then?
Maybe, yes, maybe. That's one trend that's definitely going to go further, I think, in 2013. We'll also see plenty of literary historical novels, not surprisingly, given the amazing record of Hilary Mantel. One to look out for is The Queen's Gambit, coming from Elizabeth Freemantle, which is a novel about the life of Henry VIII's last wife, Catherine Parr, which is very good, and that's coming in April. Another trend that I think we should be looking out for, which is an interesting one, it's novels about the experience of war in Iraq or Afghanistan. Obviously, we had Yellow Birds by Kevin Powers, which won the Guardian First Book Award. But I think there are going to be more of those coming up. And one to look out for is, it's titled Fobbit. And it's by an American called David Abrams. And Fobbit is an army term for a US soldier based at a forward operating base. So someone who avoids front line, essentially. And the author was himself a Fobbit in the Iraq conflict. And it's described, the book's described as reading a little bit like, you know, Catch-22 or MASH for the current generation.
Now, since we're on America, there is a big rise in the big American novel, isn't there, at the moment? And this is something that I know, Sarah, you'll be very excited about.
I am. I think it's going to be a good year for me this year.
Yes, the sweeping American novel is back, if indeed it ever went away. We've got some panoramic American novels. We've got Stuart Nadler's debut, Wise Men, which travels from the 1950s to the present day. And also a hugely tipped novel from James Salter, who won the Pulitzer Prize, which is called All That Is. And it's about a man demobbed after the Second World War who takes a job in book publishing and has a kind of difficult search for love.
It makes it sound as if we're going to be very dominated by the Americans.
I don't know about that. We certainly have mentioned a few, but there'll be plenty of good homegrown authors too.
And one other intriguing trend that you noticed, Ben, is cyberbullying.
Yes, I've been tipped to that there are going to be a number of novels. I think there are new novels from Annabelle Pitcher and Ruth Ozeki that both touch on this theme. Yeah, cyberbullying and sort of the difficulties of parenting the social media generation, I think, is a theme that's going to be coming up this year.
Mm-hmm. And slightly tangentially to that, there's an intriguing book about being stalked from one of our reviewers, in fact, isn't there,
Yes,
Sarah?
The wonderful James Lansdown, who's an absolutely fantastic writer. So I can't wait for this. It's coming out in February. It's called Give Me Everything You Have. And it's his account of being cyber-stalked by a former student who started harassing him online and posting messages about him and making all these accusations of theft and, like, alarmingly sexual misconduct with the aim of ruining him, apparently. So I think it'll be absolutely fascinating. And also it's kind of interesting to know that this person he corresponded with is having this massive drama kind of offstage that you knew nothing about. So I'll certainly be reading that one.
Okay, so let's now move in a little bit and look at what the novels are that are coming up in the spring. You've mentioned a few, Ben. I'm really excited about the Dave Eggers. Mm. I love Dave Eggers. So Hologram for the King. Have either of you read it yet?
I haven't.
It's sitting on my bedside table. And it's set in Saudi Arabia, actually, which is intriguing for him, although he has done lots. He does range far and wide, doesn't he? It's a portrait of Saudi and an allegory of declining US power, I gather. What else?
Well, there's a couple of things coming up in the spring that look really interesting. In March, we've got a new book by Kate Atkinson. This is not one of her Jackson Brodie detective series. She's gone off and done a standalone novel. And I haven't read this, but Justine Jordan, the fiction editor on the book's desk, has read it and says it's absolutely fantastic. It's called Life After Life. Set in 1910 when a baby girl is born and then she dies and then she lives again. And so it's kind of sort of fairly speculative, which is slightly new territory for her, but she is invariably excellent. So that is something to look forward to. Also in March, we've got a new book from J.M. Coetzee called The Childhood of Jesus. Going on into April, we have a book from Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie called Americana. I don't know if that's how you say it.
It's Americana with an H on the end.
Which just kind of sounds, makes me sound like a bit of an idiot, I think so. But anyway, we'll wait till to hear how people are going to pronounce that. But this is about a young couple who flee a military dictatorship in Nigeria, which was the territory of her best-known novel, Half the Yellow Sun. And they leave for America in London, and it's about the question of whether their relationship is going to be able to survive the transition, I suppose. And is also fairly reflective of what happened in her own life, I think. Then going on into May, we've got a new John le Carré book called A Delicate Truth, in which the details of a counter-terror operation in Gibraltar come to light in Cornwall many years later. So, you know, fans of le Carré, look out for that one. But actually, I'm sort of almost more excited in a real fangirly way about stuff that's coming up later in the year. In August, you have Margaret Atwood publishing the last book in her dystopian trilogy that began with Oryx and Crake and went on in The Year of the Flood, and that's called Mad Adam. And then in September, we've got a new book by Stephen King, which is a sequel to The Shining, in which Danny Torrance, who's the young boy in The Shining, is now grown up, and he's a middle-aged sort of drifter, and he uses his power, his shining, to comfort dying people. And then, unfortunately for him, there's a tribe of horrible, child-torturing paranormals who come along and sort of slightly ruin it for him. And then also a new book by Roddy Doyle in September called The Guts, in which he revisits his hero from The Commitments, Jimmy Rabbit, who's now in his late 40s, with a wife and four children.
Some really great things there, Ben, but you've got a couple of debuts up your sleeve, haven't you?
Yes, I just wanted to mention a couple of highly tipped debuts that I think will be worth us looking out for. And there is a new literary name coming up in April called Taye Selasi, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, who has a novel called Ghana Must Go.
I've actually read it, and it's fantastic.
It is fantastic, isn't it?
Another Nigerian.
Ghanaian and Nigerian. And it's set between Ghana and America, as you all know, Claire. And it's a family story, a story of, you know, family secrets and a family brought together after the sudden death of the doctor father. And that, I think, will definitely be a candidate for literary prizes. And then it's also worth mentioning that there's another debut, The Hive, in May, which is by Jill Hornby. And there is a good feedback coming from people who've read that. They say it's very funny and insightful. It's about a group of mothers who meet at the school gate, and it's kind of about the politics of their relationship and their friendships and so on. I think that'll also have a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm. Finally, it is going to be a year of anniversaries, isn't it? We're already into the 200th anniversary of Pride and Prejudice and the 50th anniversary of Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar. Is there going to be a lot of activity around those, Ben, do you think?
I think there will be, yes. There's always fascination with Sylvia Plath. And anniversaries are, in a way, they're kind of an easy opportunity to revisit some really good writing and good books. And it's a good way to draw attention to books we all love but don't think about every day.
On which note, I should probably mention at this point that our reading group this month is The Bell Jar in honour of the 50th anniversary of Plath's death. So anyone who's interested in talking about The Bell Jar should come and join in on the reading group.
We will be doing some stuff about Plath and Austen in next week's podcast. Towards the end of the year, it's the 100th anniversary of Albert Camus and the 50th of Aldous Huxley. And I think those are two writers that are absolutely ripe for rediscovery, particularly Aldous Huxley. Mm.
Yes, I remember reading him a great deal in my youth, in my teenage years, and I would love to go back to him.
He's
actually
sort of fallen out of fashion, hasn't
yes,
he?
Yes, yeah. He has, yeah.
Yeah, and he was someone whose, his brother said rather wonderfully, his brother Julian Huxley, who's an incredibly distinguished family, of course, said his uniqueness lay in his universalism. He was able to take all knowledge for his province. Sarah, what about non-fiction?
Well, we've already mentioned Give Me Everything You Have, the James Lasdon book, which is sort of memoirish non-fiction, I suppose, but is definitely one to look out for. But then in March, we have the last book from Eric Hobsbawm called Fractured Times. Hobsbawm died last year, and this is a book of his essays, several of which are previously unpublished, so will be of great interest to people who follow his work. And they focus on fragmentation of high culture, and they've taken everything from the women's movement to cowboys, apparently. So,
and we've got the second generation of Occupy books, which I'm very interested in. We've had the sort of first take, which yeah. they're sort of a whole slew of books, very quick books last year. Yeah. And this David Graeber doing his Democracy Project, which is coming out from Allen Lane, it will formulate it in a very Allen Lane way. It'll be a much more considered idea of where dissent and anti-capitalism is now, which I think is going to be very interesting. And then on that theme, in September, another book from Naomi Klein, who is taking on climate change and climate activism in The Message. Ben, how about you?
Yes, I was just going to mention William Dalrymple is back next month with Return of a King, which again is the Afghanistan theme. It's a book about the first Afghan war and the British military incursion in the 1840s. And as we know, there are quite a few interesting parallels to be drawn between that military action and the one in our own time. But he has done what he does. He's searched hard and found new sources that haven't been drawn on by Western historians before, and he has found some very interesting material that tells the story from the Afghan side, which should be really, really fascinating. And I think he had quite a hair-raising research expedition which involved the window of his car getting shot out by a sniper as he travelled from the airport, so he certainly put the effort in to bring us this book, so very much looking forward to that. And then there's a book that's creating waves that sounds interesting. I'm kind of suspending judgment till I've had a chance to see it. It's coming in April again. It's American, and it's called The Spark by a woman called Christine Barnett. She is the parent of a child who was diagnosed with autism. And I know it's a complicated area, this idea of autism and, you know, special talents. And, you know, people have, you know, different feelings about it because it does lend itself to the Rain Man stereotype. But her son apparently was retreating further and further into autism with conventional treatment, and she followed her own program where she pursued his spark of interest, his spark of passion, and he has developed really quite fantastic and amazing talents in astrophysics, and, you know, has a sort of genius IQ. So I think there's going to be quite a lot of interest and discussion in that book when it comes over.
Well, it's amazing you should end with that note, because our next guest on this podcast is, in fact, an autistic savant. He's Daniel Tammet, whose book, Thinking in Numbers, How Maths Illuminates Our Lives, is just out in paperback. Though he's a mathematician by training, his frame of reference is mind-blowing, as he reveals in this passage from his book, which he read when he paid us a visit.
Book of Books. I have walked in my sleep and talked in my sleep, but I've never written in my sleep. The Icelandic author Gyrðir Elíasson, short story Nætuskriftir, Night Writing, depicts a character whose writer's block suddenly disappears once the lights go out. In a notebook lifted from his bedside table, he begins to write down words, sentences, and even whole stories while he dreams. The days passed, all the same. He could not write. But at night he wrote. Nearly every night. His wife knew not to wake a sleep writer. So she lay in the bed and watched the expression of his back. How he wrote with amazing confidence with the notebook on his knees. Something about Eliasson's tale touches a chord in me. I think it has something to do with confronting the infinity that is every written and unwritten book, including the book of life, the infinitely many potential combinations that comprise our days. Our dreams contain the infinite. Uninhibited by wakefulness, words and pictures and emotions circulate and combine freely inside our head. Like Eliasson's sleep writer, Anton Chekhov faithfully nurtured a little notebook throughout his remarkable career. The pages preserve glimpses of ordinary life's infinite permutations. Writing half a century after his fellow countryman, another precocious note-taker, Vladimir Nabokov, composed his novels in two alphabets and three languages, Russian, French, and English. He compared composing a story with fitting together the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. Reality is a very subjective affair. You can get nearer and nearer, so to speak, to reality, but you never get near enough because reality is an infinite succession of steps, levels of perception, false bottoms, and hence unquenchable, unattainable. You can know more and more about one thing, but you can never know everything about one thing. It's hopeless. Like a jigsaw puzzle, like a dream, Nabokov's novel was emerged non-linearly. He often wrote the middle of a story last. Chapter 8 of a draft manuscript might appear long before Chapter 7 or Chapter 3. A new story he'd frequently write backwards, starting out from its final lines. Lolita, Nabokov's most famous and infamous novel, began life on a long series of 3x5-inch index cards. He sketched out the story's closing scenes first. On subsequent cards, Nabokov jotted down not only paragraphs of text, but also plot ideas and other bits of information. On one, a chart of statistics on the average height and weight of young girls. On another, a list of jukebox songs. On a third, an illustration of a revolver. Every so often, Nabokov would rearrange his index cards, searching for the most promising combination of scenes. The number of possible permutations would have been immense. Three of Nabokov's cards can be rearranged in a total of 6 different ways, while 10 cards, equivalent to between 2 and 3 printed pages in a book, would be capable of permuting into more than 3.5 million sequences. To compose only 4 or 5 pages, equivalent to the contents of about 15 index cards, would require a choice from among 1.3 trillion variations. Lolita runs to 69 chapters, over 350 pages, which means that the number of its potential versions exceeds, by an almost unimaginable margin, the number of atoms that make up our universe.
So, Daniel, there was one phrase in that, by an almost unimaginable margin. I didn't think there was such a thing in your world. I thought you could imagine every margin.
Yes, I mean, mathematics is an infinite subject. There is no end of things that we can not know about it. But we can try. We can explore all kinds of realms and possibilities, which is why I do feel that mathematics is pretty close to literature. And I think that the two need to be explored together. They're not strangers to each other, more like cousins. And so my book attempts to bridge that chasm and show that imagination, the science of imagination, which is what I call mathematics, is very close to the same experience of imagination and trying to figure out all these possibilities as novelists are.
I noticed a bit of a trick that you have in this book, which is a lot of the essays begin with a literary anecdote. Mm. So, for example, you've got "few things to judge by his works so fascinated William Shakespeare as the presence of absence." And then in another one, you've got "the history of the world," Tolstoy said, "is the history of little people." And each of these then become an exploration of a scientific concept.
I mean, Tolstoy was fascinated by mathematics. One of his best friends was a mathematician. In War and Peace, he wrote a great deal about calculus and the idea that history could be understood using calculus, that historians were always trying to simplify by taking a hero like Napoleon and saying, well, France invaded Russia in 1812 because of Napoleon, because he was, you know, of his character, he was war hungry and so on. And Tolstoy said, well, no, there are an infinitely many number of factors for any given event at any given time. And the fact that Napoleon's desire to invade at that given time was coincidence, and it could have been any other number of factors. Obviously, historians were very troubled by it, but I think they've moved a lot closer to his position since. Nowadays, it's quite common to see historical books explore big events from the perspective of ordinary people, as we would call them, people who were just walking down the street, you know, when the bombs came during the Blitz, for example, and looking at history from their perspective as well.
Now, in a completely different chapter to that, you talk about Tolstoy hating railways because of the inequality that they represented. Mm.
Yes, he famously threw his favourite character, Anna Karenina, under a train. And the reason is because he was very much for this idea of equality, kind of a rustic equality. And railways represented inequality, the idea that you could have a huge amount of resources funneled into a single project that would, in theory at least, benefit the whole of society. But of course, the people who built the railways never rode on them. And I guess, in Tolstoy's view, this was extremely unfair.
You came to prominence with your memoir, Born on a Blue Day, which is about your own growing up as an autistic savant with enormous capacities. And running through this latest book, Thinking in Numbers, is a picture of you as a child, as a growing person, sort of grappling with both yourself and with the world. And there's a lovely chapter which opens with you as a little boy being introduced to the idea of infinity by the Grimm's fairy tales.
Yes.
By, on the one hand, the magic porridge pot, which was huge, and on the other hand, the Princess and the Pea, which was the infinitesimally small.
Yeah, absolutely. I loved fairy tales. They were extremely vivid, full of imagery, and the language was very simple, and at the time, as a small child growing up, language was very complicated. It was a bit of a minefield. I didn't realise how many words were ambiguous, how important social context is. And this is something that for people who have very high functioning autism like I have, it's tricky and it takes time to learn. And so fairy tales were one way that I could get into literature, I guess. And I read these stories as well for the mathematics because, as you say, in the case of the magic porridge pot, the idea was you had this pot that could produce an infinite amount of porridge that if you didn't say, stop, little pot, stop, the porridge would just keep coming. It would never stop. And the idea that you could somehow have all these infinitely many grains and drops of milk and bits of sugar and put them all back into one tiny pot just sounded amazing. And of course, years later, when I read about these mathematicians and the study of infinity, I realised that actually it's not as fantastic as it sounded.
But it sounds like you must have been quite an anxious little boy. Those are very big things to think about when you're lying in your bed at night.
I don't think I experienced them as anxiety. I just found them fascinating. I realised that the world was bigger than my limitations, and that if I pushed myself very hard to learn the social skills that I found difficult, to learn the language and to read even books that I would have found very difficult to understand, that I could overcome those limitations, and that mathematics and literature, because both offer ways into the infinity of human imagination, were wonderful ways of doing that.
I was very interested in the way you talk about your family. And one of them, you describe, you're one of nine children, and you say we were set part of the category of things that people refer to when they use the number nine.
I was always struck at how surprised people were when I said that I was one of nine children. And it dawned on me that there were two reasons. One is that we experience very small numbers in our day-to-day lives, 1, 2, and 3 and so on. So if you put them, relate them to colours, so 0 and 1 would be black and white, 2, 3, 4, these would be the primary colours, yellow and red and so on. And by the time you get to 9, I guess you'd be up to, indigo or something like this. So experiencing something as commonplace as a family with a number as unusual, relatively speaking, as nine, would be like meeting a woman with indigo-coloured hair, for example, in the street.
In a synesthesics world, which we haven't actually said yet, you are synesthesic
as
well.
Yeah.
But I don't think in colours. I don't see nine as indigo. I don't know, you know, this is fascinating to me.
Yeah. The other example is you mentioned nine as being a set. It's mathematical talk, but it just means that everything that contains nine items, like the nine justices of the Supreme Court or nine members of a baseball team or the nine planets, at least before Pluto was taken out of the solar system. And in fact, you'd have to do a bit of a calculation, but basically there are 512 ways of combining my brothers and sisters. You could have the first and the second and the third, you could have the first and the fourth, you could have the first and the ninth, and so on and so on. So I guess growing up, the people in my town, they had 512 ways of bumping into us. So I guess we would have seemed, you know, legion, so that makes sense to me now.
And you also have a very touching chapter about trying to analyse your mother to come up with a system which would enable you to understand your mother, who is somehow mysterious and is still mystifying to you.
Absolutely. Well, the more I've grown up, the more I realise that everyone is mystifying in a way, and that's part of what makes life so interesting, and what we go to when we go to a book, a novel, you know, when we try to figure out someone like Anna Karenina or one of the characters in the Raymond Carver short stories, for example, and they're just so mysterious, and yet we try to grapple with that mystery. And in the book I say that anticipation is an act of love, you know, the very fact that we try to, knowing that we will fail in some way, that we can never really say in 3 minutes you're going to ask me such and such question and then you're going to do such and such a thing with your pen and then you're going to we can't, and thank God in a way, because it would make life awful in a way if everything was just puppetry and we could pull all the strings. And so my essay is a tribute to my mum and a tribute to her mystery, and so many readers have said to me, my mum is a mystery to me as well, so I'm not the only one. I think that you can mathematically predict people's behaviour to some extent, and in that chapter I do point out that, for example, the research of Soviet scientists at the time who worked out that schoolgirls, you could predict quite accurately what they were going to say based on what they'd said up to that point. You could predict their next word, whereas journalists were relatively easy to predict, but poets were a nightmare. You couldn't work out what they're going to say next. So prediction is just part and parcel of our life, but you have to realise it has limits, and there's a certain point where you can't predict, and that's what makes life so interesting, and that's what makes poetry so good as well, when it is good, that it is unexpected.
And the book ends with a plea for these two worlds to be integrated, and there just feels like there's a huge weight of a sort of passion in it, because actually you were humanized by language,
and by literature. People assume that autism is somehow incompatible with literature. There is speculation that Emily Dickinson was autistic, would have been considered as being part of the autistic spectrum at the time if it had existed. Lewis Carroll, possibly Asperger's, we don't know. So I don't think it is incompatible with reading and writing and a love of literature. And I've always loved books. As I've got older and as I've evolved, my reading has evolved, my writing as well. It's become more literary, more sophisticated, and I hope that progress will continue and accelerate as well.
Daniel Tammet there. Thinking in Numbers is published by Hodder. And that's it from us for this week. If you missed our short story series, you have a treat in store. You can find all the podcasts by going to the front of the book site at guardian.co.uk/books and clicking on the podcast tab at the top of the page. Do come back next week. Do tell all your friends about us. And do let us know if there's anything you'd like us to cover in the new year. Until next week, thanks to Benedicta Page, Sarah Crown and Daniel Tammet. From me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Tim Mabey, goodbye.
Visit audible.co.uk/Guardian Audio to choose from a selection of over 60,000 titles. With Audible, you can make more time for books by downloading and listening wherever you are and whatever you're doing.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.